Hello and welcome to Happy Place, the show where we reach across the divide and provide some much needed human connection and inspiration with the help of some very special guests. I'm Fern Cotton, and a huge thank you for all the wonderful feedback on our episode with Kelly Jones. Nad Loves to Run got in touch on Apple Podcasts to say, "So glad I chose to walk instead of a run, as this episode would have stopped me in my tracks." We all know that Kelly is talented, but this showed him in a truly different light, which makes you love and admire him on another level. I literally grew up a few miles away from Kelly, and to hear him talk so openly is very inspiring. I wish him and his family the very best for the future. Oh my God, I mean, I'm goosebumps from head to toe. Nad, thank you so much for that. I so appreciate your time and energy. It was a remarkable story, and I'm so grateful to Kelly that he chose to talk about it on the podcast. It was brave, it was insightful, eloquent, and really, really helpful to a lot of people. I've spoken to Kelly on the phone a couple of times since the podcast went out, and he's also, you know, he can't believe the reaction and how many people have sent such lovely messages and have said that it's helped them too. So thank you from me, and I guess I can also say a big thank you from Kelly too. Now, we had loads like this. Thank you for every single one. Each time you react to the episodes, it really means a lot. I really can't thank you enough. I hope that today inspires you in other ways as we spend time with Ricky Gervais.
You know, I think of life, it's like a holiday. We don't exist for 13 and a half billion years. Then we have these 80, 90, 100 years, if we're lucky, of consciousness and introspection and joy and laughter and wine. Mm. And then we die, never to exist again. And so what do we do with it? Well, we make the most of it.
Star of The Office, comedian and creator of the hit Netflix series, my absolute favourite, Afterlife. If you haven't seen it, please go try it now. I mean, I've never laughed or cried so much during a TV show. It's beautiful is what it is, bloody beautiful. Ricky has unsurprisingly plenty to say about the world. You can look forward to that.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, here's the show. Hi, Ricky.
Hello. I haven't got a... I'm not under a duvet, but I think the sound's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely fine. It will add some atmosphere. But yeah, I've tried my... I've been recording all of my radio shows from under here as well. So,
Good.
That's how we're doing it.
Good.
It's ludicrous. The whole thing is...
Very comfortable.
It's not at all, actually. I'm sat on the floor with my legs straddling a chair that my laptop and microphone are on.
Great.
But hey, you know, we're in weird times, aren't we?
Yeah. What's weird about it is it's global.
Mm.
Nothing is global like this. Not, you know, not at the same time, you know. Even like weather. Weather's global, but it's different everywhere. You know, it is strange. And it's the fact that it's on the news. The thing you're going through is on the news all the time. That's what's... Yeah. The weird thing, and everyone knows that everyone's in the same boat. That's the strange thing, really. Anyway.
I know, it's a weird one. I think a lot of people are, you know, like I certainly am sort of just fumbling through it all and trying to work out my own barometer of how much of that I can take on board. Because a lot of that, obviously, the stuff that we're sort of digesting and imbibing from the news or social media, whatever, is
fear-based, and I think you do have to work out what you're capable of taking on.
As soon as I was resigned to everything, it was okay. What I didn't like was that period about a month ago when you didn't know what the right thing to do was. Like, if they don't cancel the gigs, do I cancel the gigs? You know,
yeah.
All those things. Just not. But then when they said we're in lockdown, I thought, great, that's it. Everyone's in the same boat. No whinging. Let's get on with it. We're postponing normal life for however long. And as you know, I've said many times, you won't hear me complain. Not when there's nurses who are doing 14-hour shift. Do you know what I mean? It's like I have no right to complain about anything. And the other thing, if I'm being honest, is it hasn't affected me as much as most people. You know, I'm right. Apart from the gigs being postponed, I'm writing. I don't go out anyway. There's always enough booze in the house for a nuclear winter, so it's business as usual. We are playing badminton in the garden, which is great.
Ooh.
You find that badminton kit you bought 3 years ago and it's never been used. And then you think, right, here we go.
And you're lucky. There's been no wind. It's perfect badminton weather.
I know. It's been good badminton weather, I must say. There's the headline.
That is the headline. Ricky Gervais loves badminton. I have to personally kind of officially start this episode by thanking you for creating Afterlife, because I don't think I've ever watched anything so thoughtful in my entire life. And I just lapped up series one. I've been lucky enough to see a preview of series two, which again had a similar effect on me. And it's just beautiful. I've never laughed and cried as much in an episode. I've had stuff that's made me, you know, piss myself laughing and stuff that's made me feel like I can't breathe with tears. But this has done both. And I think that's such a bizarre and unique skill to have, that when you're writing, you can tap into both. I find that extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, I think I've always tried to reflect real life. I've been plagued with realism, not just in things that, you know, could happen, but, you know, often things that have. You know, everything is sort of semi-autobiographical, I guess. Everything's sort of vaguely existential. I don't know where that comes from. Maybe it's because I'm an atheist and I think this is all we've got. So I'm sort of obsessed with not only making the most of your life, but, you know, the knowing it's finite. And you know, I suppose you reflect. I don't sit around, you know, in a sheet being all like you, being all philosophical. I just, you know, that these are things that you now and again sort of ponder through your life, you know, and the older you get, the more you've pondered things, I think. But yeah, I as you get older and as you get better at your work, I don't think I want to be bigger or I want to get more viewers or win more awards. I think I want to be more honest. Every time it's like waking up, you go, ah, I could be even more honest now. I'm peeling away more and more layers. Oh my God, this is the rawest I've ever been. And then in a year's time, I go, no, it wasn't. This is, I thought of a way to be even more honest and more raw. And that's my sort of obsession. And when people say things like, oh my God, it was a tough watch, or it was harsh, or it was brutal, what they mean is it was real.
Yeah.
In fiction, whatever you watch in fiction, it's not as harsh as real life. There, you know, when you see an amazing movie or you go, oh, that was tough. Then you watch a documentary about real lives and you go, shit, that was nothing. They watered it down. You know, real life is harsh. Real life is brutal. Real life is finite. And if you can sort of condense all those fears and feelings, I think people resonate with it. And I think we second guess people too much as artists or creators. And often it's not our fault. I think everyone starts out with those good intentions. And then it gets watered down. Like, you know, if this was normal TV, it wouldn't be on. They say, right, cut about 9 of the C words in the first episode, and then we can maybe broadcast it. Cut a few more, and we can put it on before 9, and you'll get more viewers. Cut that storyline. You can't have the, we need this, we need... And soon you go, okay, and lots of little compromises. You're back to square one.
Yeah.
So I think it's a reflection of... I've lived long enough to sort of... see a few things and be honest and ponder all those things you've said. Netflix has no interference. But I think mainly it's because people are used to being patronised and there's no need. Who are we to second guess what people at home can take?
Yeah.
They can take anything. They've heard worse language in their building site or their canteen or, you know, they really have.
I know, it's bizarre.
They've been worse things, you know.
And, but it takes, I don't know if it's confidence or a comfort in your own beliefs to go ahead and work in that way. Because, like you say, so many people don't. TV traditionally doesn't approach subject matters in that way. It does kind of mute or dilute.
That's a good question, really. Is it bravery or not caring or a bit of both? I don't know. I mean, I would worry if I did all this, it would be a Pyrrhic victory to do something so outrageous and so offensive and so unpleasant that no one would watch it and the broadcaster would go, you lost money, we're not doing it again. Mm. So you do have those considerations, but I do want it to be palatable as well. It's not like I'm trying to scare people off or ruin their day. I want people to like this, and I think that's the tricky bit, that you want to deal with all these taboo subjects and lead people by the hand through a scary forest, but you want to bring them out the other side. Otherwise, there's no joy. This is still just entertainment. I'm not lecturing anyone. I'm not teaching anyone. I want them to enjoy these half hours. And I think people, what I found is that... I enjoy crying as much as laughing.
Yeah.
It's still a workout. We create our own heroes and villains as a role play for the soul. And you go through all these emotions like they were real, but they're not. So no one really got hurt. And I love that juxtaposition that people are laughing and then crying. But that happens in real life too. My mum's funeral, my dad's funeral. We were crying, but we were laughing because the people were saying funny things about them. It was a celebration. And I think celebrating life is taking everything. It's, you can't pick and choose. You can't cherry pick. Obviously, the aim is to fill your days with more joy and happiness and as little pain as possible. But, you know, life, to a certain extent, there is a bit of pain. There is a bit of pain in it. And it does make you stronger, and it's worth trying hard. You know, that's painful to some people. My favourite thing is sitting on the couch with a bottle of wine, watching Netflix with Jane, and that's it. But you've got to work to be able to do that all the time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And those little mundane things, those little chores, they get you through. Afterlife is about the mundane saving his life. He had to feed the dog. He's got to go to work to earn enough money to get drunk. You know, we compromise all the time.
But, you know, watching the show, I don't think anyone would go, Ricky's just written this to shock people. You can see that it's just you being brutally honest, which is, you know, exactly what you've just said. The show is founded on it's truth and it's honesty. And we're not really used to that, especially in this country. You know, we are used to sort of lying and being a bit passive aggressive after saying no or saying yes when we really mean the opposite. And it's bizarre because you're just sort of confronting that and saying, well, actually, I don't have time for that anymore. And I wonder if you've, from practicing
well, I get that.
That
I get, I, people do that because they think that they want an easy life. But and often sometimes there's a conflict between what's right and what's honest and what's an easy life.
Yeah.
You know, the only reason I ever lie is because it's easier than telling the truth sometimes. Right? And I don't mean big, like, I mean, can you come to the christening? Oh, I can't. I'm giving blood at the orphanage. Now, that is because I don't want to say, when honestly, we don't like you that much and your friends are awful. And
yeah.
It's like we don't want to do that. That sort of truth isn't good for anyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the sort of thing we do all the time, you know. And when you've got a fictional character, and I made him have nothing to lose so he could do those things.
Yeah. Like,
usually when we're mugged, we hand over the money because we might have a baby in a stroller, or they might know where we live, or we don't, you know, all these things. We go, it's easy to hand over the money. We're thinking, oh, I want to smash him in the face with this tin of dog food. And in a fiction, I can go, let's smash him in the face with this tin of dog food, you know?
And so, like telling Kath, like, you're boring. Just wonderful release for him. Just saying, I think you're boring. Yeah. And we all think it, but we don't say it.
Yeah, we say it. And also, we don't say it because it's not nice. You know, not everything Tony does is right. I like that. I like the ambiguity of morality, that he's not right all the time. But the reason he's doing things that are wrong is because he's hurt.
Yeah, he's in pain.
He's wounded. He's got his leg in a trap, and he doesn't know if this person coming to save him or make it worse. You know, so that's the dilemma. I had to make sure the audience felt sorry for him, for them to care, because if this guy was just a horrible, misanthropic, grumpy, cruel, aggressive, you'd go, I'm not watching this. But we know why. We know he's hurt. We want to hug him because we're nice. We're human. We go, oh, yeah, okay. I feel sorry for him, you know. Even if you don't like someone, you can still feel sorry for them, because that's what being human is. It's all about empathy, and drama's about empathy, and comedy's about empathy. And I think you have to care about someone to even watch them. But the comedy comes from two sort of different places. One, it comes from us living vicariously through his candor. Because we know we can't say those things, you know, but we want to, we laugh as a release. We go, wouldn't it be funny if I could say those things, but I can't. Right? And so someone saying them for us, that's funny. The other thing it comes from is the staple of comedy is an ordinary person trying to do something they're not equipped to do. We laugh at the blind spot, you know, with David Brent or whoever. We're laughing at the blind spot. We're laughing at the what they think of themselves and what we really think of them. But that's still empathetic. We're sort of going, oh, I've done that. Or at least, oh, God, that's worse than me. So, and what Tony tried to do was to turn himself into this badass. He tried to make himself a psychopath so he wouldn't feel pain anymore. And he can't, because he's not.
Yeah.
He's not. He's basically, he's burdened. He's a nice person, and he's burdened with all these good things like guilt and sympathy. And, you know, he cares about people. He's the vulnerable, you know. He cared about his dog and his nephew and the new girl and the old lady in the graveyard. This one sort of starts with him thinking, well, okay, I can use my superpower for good. What I'll do is I'll still punish people, but I'll only punish people who deserve it. So now he's trying to negotiate, you know.
Well, also, and you see him in series two kind of open up a little bit to empathy for others, because Matt's now struggling in series two. So he's having to look outside of his own world, which in series one, he didn't really have to do.
Well,
he was just in such bitter pain.
Yeah, there's a couple of lines in that give that point, is that sometimes it's good to be needed. Sometimes you can be feeling sorry for yourself, but then you realise that helping someone else makes you feel better as well.
Yeah.
It's a Wonderful Life, one of the best movies ever, one of my favourite movies. It starts with an angel jumping in the river. So a man who's about to commit suicide has to save him. It's brilliant. It's such a brilliant setup for empathy and kindness and worth and humanity. It represents all those things in one little scene. And you know, Tony was going to kill himself, but the dog was hungry. And I thought that's a lovely. It's sort of funny, but it's also real. It's very real. You know, you go, well, it's not the dog's fault. I'll feed the dog first. And so all those things, and Anne in the graveyard in series two, you know, she says, you know, it's better to be needed. You have to have worth as well. It's one of the, if you have to tick all the boxes of the meaning of life, worth would certainly be near the top, whether people know it or not. You know?
Yeah, well, it's undervalued. Like, you know, we put in the modern world so many bullshit concepts ahead of worth that, you know, like, even, and I feel like you're challenging this within the show, but, you know, being seen in the modern world has weirdly got this huge importance, whether it's on social media or YouTube or whatever, and in your local paper, everyone wants to be on the front page, like Brian's desperate to be on the front page. You know, worth and empathy and compassion, those wonderful qualities are so far down the list because being seen is so important, strangely.
That's exactly right. People have mistaken narcissism for worth. They've mistaken loving yourself for no reason is as good as loving yourself for good reason. And you should love yourself because you've done good things and you're a good moral person. You put people before yourself and you leave the world a better place than you came into it. All those things. Those are the reasons to love yourself. Just taking a picture of yourself and putting it out there and getting likes, that's no reason to love yourself. You know?
Yeah.
And I think it's a whole generation that have made that mistake. You know, there's people taking selfies at Auschwitz. And it's like, I don't know where to start. But social media also started the problem with this myth of we've always had, I talk about this in humanity, we've always had, my opinion is worth as much as your opinion. And that's true. But then what happened was we've got my opinion is worth as much as your fact. Like the amount of likes or retweets proved you right. Well, no, that just means they're all idiots too. You know, truth is not a democracy. It's either right or it isn't. You know, lots of people getting together and saying the earth is flat doesn't change the shape of the earth. And that's what, you know, that's what you want to get across with the difference between truth and popular opinion. You know?
I'm so fascinated with this subject of truth, truth telling, knowing what your own truth stands for. I'm writing a book around this subject at the moment. And mainly I think, and this is one of the reasons why I love Afterlife so much again, and why I love what you do so much, is because I'm often not great at it. I wuss out, I worry way too much about what the general consensus will be, what people's opinion of me will be. And I sometimes look at your work in whatever guise it's in, and I think, I wonder if you have any concern for that, what other people think or what they're going to say and how they're going to judge what you do.
Yes, of course you do, because I'm human and I'd rather people liked my work than hated it. But then you've got to analyse why, because some people hate me because I exist. Some people hate me because I'm an atheist. Some people have. So you'd say, you know, some people are hated because of the colour of their skin. It doesn't mean the person hating is right, you know.
Yeah.
And I've applied that often to offence. Just because you're offended doesn't mean you're right, because some people are offended by equality, you know. And so we have to look at why someone's offended and why someone hates you and why. And that's about integrity and that's about self-belief, and they have to be right. So if I see a bad review of when I work and they go this and that, I can go, well, that's not true. But if they hit someone, I go, oh, that's true. They're right. I did. They're right. That hurts a lot more.
Yeah.
And so you can go, okay, I should address that. You would be a psychopath to go, I'm never going to listen to anyone's opinion except myself, right? Yeah. And I mean that in real life. You know, it's different in art because, you know, that is a bit of a dictatorship and you shouldn't second guess anyone with art because it is only down to opinion. So it is only yours that matters. You're doing your thing. But if you mean in real life, do I go around not caring what people think of me or not go, well, no, of course not. The opposite is true. When I first did The Office and there was a chance that I'd become famous, I feared that because I thought, oh, what if someone slags me off? Oh, I don't deserve it. I'm a nice person. What if someone lies about me? I've seen them lie about people. And then when it happens, the first time it happens, you go, oh, that's not true. You look on Wikipedia. None of this is true. And then you think, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and then when you get older, and it's taken me a long time, you know, 10, 15 years probably, and then you suddenly realise that reputation is important, but reputation is what strangers think of you. Character is what counts because that's what you really are and that's what friends know you as. So that's what counts. And it takes a long time to have a thick skin because, you know, we're human. You can't... Anyone who says they're not a little bit annoyed by a bad review, even for it's only for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't wallow. I don't care. In fact, I quite like it now. I actually quite like it because it's wiggling a tooth. It's it's being alive.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From what you've said a moment ago about people's opinions, you know, they're all obviously subjective and it doesn't mean that they're right. I have sensed that you might actively like challenging that and going, well, let's throw some stuff out there and see what people say and then still go, oh, no, I still don't care.
Well, exactly. But I think you have to separate the work from real life because...
Of course.
Because I am very different. On stage, I've worked on it. The work can stand up for itself. For me to go around saying those things to strangers for no reason that I say in terms of comedy or drama or irony or whatever, no, it would be horrific because I don't want to hurt people's feelings. I don't want to. People think that because I'm an atheist, I run into churches and going, there is no God, you're all idiots. There's nothing further from the truth. It's like, why would I do that? Why would I? It's nothing to do with me what people believe in. But when I'm analysing it, and for comedy or drama, then that's my world. I'm allowed to do that. I'm allowed to, you know, it's like getting angry at maths. And the problem comes, I want to tell people they shouldn't take jokes personally. This isn't really me. And I think people make the mistake that any joke, they think the joke is a window to the comedian's soul. They think that that's your true feelings. And it isn't. It could be the opposite. I'll structure a joke and I try and make that joke as funny as possible. I could take on a completely different side of the argument. I'll flip halfway through a joke and I go, no, it's better if I pretend to be really right wing for this joke. You know, and people get confused because I go back and forth and then I do something that's real and I get angry about animal cruelty, and then I go back to getting things wrong, you know. And
well, this
you've
is,
got to
you
assume
know,
that the audience are clever enough to know. I start my new stand-up like Supernature. I come out and I tell a joke, right, and it gets a laugh, and that gets a groan because it's sort of an off colour. And I go, that was irony. That's when I, as a comedian, say something I don't really believe to elicit a laugh in the audience, and you're laughing at the wrong thing because you know what the right thing is. So I'm making fun of them understanding, but it's actually very good because they remember that. And then when I go out and I do another one, I go, don't let me down now, don't let me down. Mm-hmm. So I challenge them to understand they shouldn't take this personally because it's just a joke. And this myth that you know, some jokes punch up and some punch down. Jokes don't punch anywhere. That's a metaphor. But people go, oh no, it really did punch. It punched someone in the face and it hurt them. It didn't. It's a collection of words used to elicit a joke, you know, elicit a laugh. I think that we've sort of reached the peak recently where people did take jokes personally, and some people take the truth personally. I talk about that in Humanity, where sometimes I'll tweet something provocative, and I know that they're going to take it. I say, happy birthday, Earth, 4.6 billion years old. And someone always says, why are you having a go at creationism? So they jumped in the way of the bullet. And I was sort of, but you can't take the age of the Earth personally.
Yeah, but I think you can, once, you know, and I've heard you sort of dissect this kind of thing before, and also I've watched enough of your work to see how you oscillate between the absolute ridiculous silliness to like very deep thought and analysis of things that do need to be challenged. And I enjoy watching you challenge them, because also the reaction's interesting to watch, sort of to see how, you know, people vary in their reaction, whether it's shock, faux shock, you know, finding it hilarious or utter disgust, and how it probably says a lot more about them than anything in the situation. And it's enjoyable to watch that dissected, because like you say, we have reached this sort of strange peak of nobody really knowing what the line is or what the joke is or if they should take it personally or what any of us are allowed to say. And I wonder what the line is for you.
Exactly. And sometimes, you know, I think 20 years ago, if you make a joke or do a routine or do something and people, you know, say, oh, that's really offensive, you'd look into it. You'd go, really, why? They go, oh, okay. Now if someone says I'm offended, yeah, I know, everyone is. Don't worry about it. You know, some people think that I'm offended is an argument. And what they mean is, I don't want you to say that again because it hurts my feelings. Whereas you will say, well, but where's your argument? What's your argument? Why are you telling me this? Why do you expect me to do anything about it? And I think offence is easier these days. 20 years ago, if you saw someone on telly, you offended, you had to get out a piece of paper and a letter and go, dear BBC, I can't be bothered. But now you fire off a tweet and it's picked up, and it's like road rage. Twitter's fast. It's fast. So you can start it and tempers are fast. And so it all gets out of hand. Whereas if you calm it down and go, well, what are you really saying? What's your argument? And very often it comes down to people took it personally when they didn't need to. Or I think 9 times out of 10, people mistake the target of the joke with the subject. And that they think you shouldn't, you know, that you shouldn't joke about a certain subject, which is just untrue. It depends what the joke is. We discuss every subject. Journalists write about every subject. Where's this weird rule that a comedian can't joke about a subject? You know, it depends on the target. And that's what I can't stress that enough, that when you look into it, there's no reason to be offended by it. Again, it's like being offended by maths. It doesn't affect you. It's not real harm, you know?
I find it so fascinating because I guess so much of your work is driven by this undercurrent of like needing to challenge things that either irk you or needing to challenge concepts that are widely thrown about that you don't necessarily agree with. And, you know, we all have that choice in life. And I'm certainly driven by things that I feel a certain amount of discomfort with or unrest, and I write about them or do podcasts or whatever it is, create something about it to try and figure it out. And I wonder what it is for you that drives you, because you could just go, oh, I don't fucking care, whatever, but it seems to really drive your work.
Well, that's true as well. I could say that, you're right, you know, I could go, oh, I can't be bothered, or who cares? And yeah. that's true for everything, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
So given that this is sort of my profession and my interest, I do it. It's like I'm mining yeah. for interesting things, and interesting things that get a reaction, hopefully get a laugh. So that's all I'm doing. I'm looking everywhere. And sometimes you don't have to look. Sometimes it comes and hits you in the face and you go, well, that's what's my first reaction. And it does come down to a different point of view or an honesty. And sometimes people go, oh, I've thought that, but I've never been able to put it into words. Or they say, I've never thought of it that way. And there's no right or wrong thing to elicit discussion and thought. And I deal in taboo subjects because they're less mined by definition. They're fresh territory.
You see this so much in Afterlife. There's so many subject matters that you could extract in that way. Another one, aside from grief, is loneliness. You know, each character seems to have their own element of loneliness, whether it's Emma the nurse, Tony's dad with dementia, the sex worker Daphne, Julian the drug addict. Everyone seems to have this sort of isolation in life, or yeah. they feel ostracized. Why was that a subject matter that felt important to explore with this series?
Because it's true. It's true. Everyone's got their own problems. And sometimes we ignore them and we think that we're in the worst position. And, you know, that you know, we feel sorry for ourselves and we're very spoiled, you know. And sometimes it takes something to snap you out of that. And that's what I mean with helping someone who's worse off than you. Is sometimes it makes you feel good about yourself, even down to when I was a kid and my mum made me a meal that wasn't my favourite meal, right? She'd go, there's kids starving in Africa. And that sounds like quite a crass thing, but I thought, yeah, and in a weird way, that terrible thing makes you feel better about yourself because you don't want to feel spoiled.
I do it to my kids. I wish I didn't, but I do say quite often, there are kids with no toys out there. Just yeah. play with the toy I've given you or whatever.
Yeah, and maybe it's not, maybe they don't quite get it, but you do eventually. And it's really true. It's yeah. just true. And there's a line in the first series of Afterlife where, you know, my brother-in-law Matt says, what, you've just suddenly realised that other people have problems too. And he says, next time, you know, you get a waitress fired because your suit's cold, remember she might have just found out her mother's got cancer. And again, I always think that. And you put yourself there. You remember what you were like when you heard terrible news and that people were nice to you or they weren't nice to you or how you felt. And you just try and apply that because you don't want people, if you're a nice person, you don't want anyone to be going through terrible things. And again, if you're a nice person, you can't enjoy all your good things if there's terrible things in front of you. So you try and make that. Is everyone good? Is everyone well? Yeah, good. I can enjoy it then. And you can't beat yourself up about it, but because there are bad things happening all the time. But you can. Another line that probably says, you know, you can't change the world, but you can change your little corner of it, you know, and if everyone did that, it would be a better world. So, yes, I sort of do. I do think everyone's got their own problems. But we've still got this narcissism creeping in that we think, well, no one's as bad off as me. I do a routine in Humanity that's based on a true story. I did a routine on Jimmy Fallon about nut allergies. You know, it's a joke that I get on a plane, and when there's a woman with a fatal nut allergy and we're not allowed to, and it's, none of this is true. I'm going, I never wanted nuts more. I thought, I wish I'd brought my own on with me. So now what I do is rub myself down with nuts in case I go. So it's, none of it's true, obviously, right? But it gets good.
Yeah.
So the next day on Twitter, someone's got, how dare you joke about nut allergies? My daughter's got a nut allergy. Da, da. And so first of all, I thought, well, that's crazy. But then she carries on and she's atting NBC and she's atting Jimmy Fallon. And I'm thinking, ignore it. This is crazy. You can't explain. And then she sends me this thing. You should never joke about food allergies. And I just thought that was just such a, and I know she's in a terrible position, but I just thought it was such an arrogant thing to say. She doesn't know me. She doesn't, the routine wasn't true. I'm not really that selfish. I don't really think it's a thing to joke about that if it was real. So I said, I joke about AIDS, cancer, famine, and the Holocaust. And you're telling me I shouldn't joke about food allergies. And she sent back, yes, but the Holocaust didn't kill children. So she was so consumed in her own problem that she thought no other problem is as bad as this. And again, that's human. We live in our head. We go, no, this is terrible. It's not as bad as what I'm feeling. Because we can't put ourselves in other people's brains for a day. If we could, we'd go, let me get back in my brain. It wasn't so bad.
Do you think it's been sort of exasperated? Like, so say that anecdote about, you know, the waitress making the wrong soup or your soup's cold. Do you think that we have dehumanised others and that's become exasperated because of how we now use our phones, our laptops, social media? We don't see each other so much as other humans. What we're seeing is another person to vent our anger on, or it's just that person doesn't necessarily have emotion attached to what they're saying, or...
Yeah, I think it's always been there that we, you know, we're all a little bit selfish sometimes, and we go, you know, what about my life? You know, people feel guilty about putting their parents in their home, but then you go, yeah, but they've got a life as well, and it's just bad luck, and oh, I don't know what to do. And people have always had these dilemmas that, you know, but what about me? That we're human. You know, cavemen used to put their hand on a cave and blow woad over it and go, look, I was here. I was here. And we've always got that. But it's just out of hand with social media because, you know, it's like being able to read every toilet wall in the world at once. It's just noise. Yes. It's people shouting out of a window. It's emptying drawer out of a window. It's going, look, all this stuff. It's me, me, me. And there's a new form of narcissism. There's an uber narcissism. And that's because like breeds like. So you see these people who have worked out and they've got their shirt off and they're on a plane, a private plane that they've hired for the day. And they make people go, I'm not achieving anything. I'm rubbish.
Yeah,
I need to work out and get a plane, you know. And
it's evil.
It's not true. It's not true. You know what? Just everyone, just do what you like. Happiness is all we're trying to do. That's all we're trying to be. We're just trying to get through life and be mostly happy and feel good about ourselves. And sometimes we go around the houses and we think about that. What's happiness? Oh, it's being famous, or it's having 9 cars. If I had 10 cars, I'd even be, you can't drive 10 cars. That doesn't make you 10 times happier.
But you demonstrate this in the show. Like, you know, you see all Tony wants is to be on the sofa with his wife, having a glass of wine and having a laugh. And that bit really resonated with me because I hate going out. It's my worst nightmare. I adore being at home and doing very little. But like you've just illustrated, I very often think, God, you know, should I be living my best life? Should I be like living it to the max? And I'm like, I don't want to. And I've had to find peace in the fact that I am a homebody. I like just being at home and chilling out. And that does make me happy. There is no one equation to this. Honestly, mythical happiness.
The things that people think make you happy, everything I do has to compete with me sitting on the sofa, being slightly too full of pasta with a half a bottle of wine to go, watching another episode of a Scandi noir drama about serial killers. It's like,
heavenly.
It's like, do you want to the pub? No, look what I've got. Do you want to go to this red carpet? No, look what I've got. It's like nothing. What? Do you want to go and stand in a noisy bar? No, I really don't. So you've just got to know what makes you happy and believe it and just and just do that all the time.
I totally agree. There's one line that, again, I love in series one when Tony says, "Hope is everything." And I think, well, yeah, especially at the moment with what's going on, but for many people, hope feels like a very far-fetched, mythical notion that they can't grab hold of. And I wonder what you personally believe in life is a way to harness hope when you really feel like none is afoot.
Well, I think hope is there for a very good reason. It sort of keeps you going, you know, as an evolutionary trait or whatever, or as a, you know, it's a bit of a medicine. It's a bit of an opiate, you know. And I just think it goes, okay, life's going to get better. If it's bad, it's worth living to get it good again, or to get it good for the first time. And, you know, that is a consideration, because there comes a point where you can decide that, well, actually, the day is now, and for the future until the end, there's going to be more pain in my life than joy. You know, that's a terrible decision that some people have to make. And, you know, that's in there as well. You know, the big question that afterlife asks is, when you lose everything, is life still worth living? And you do have to weigh it up. You make a mental list of pros and cons, and it's a decision that some people have to make genuinely, which is very, very sad. But on a lighter note, in general, what we mean is things like, I've had some bad news. I've lost my job, but you know what I mean? I'll get a better job. You know, everyday things. Oh, the house we wanted fell through. Oh, maybe we'll get a better one. You know, all those little things, you know, that sometimes the hope isn't the big question. It's, I hope they cancel that christening I've promised to go to.
It resonates a lot.
It depends. It's all a matter of degrees. And you negotiate life. But the big question is, am I more or less happy? You know, I think of life, it's like a holiday. We don't exist for 13 and a half billion years. Then we have these 80, 90, 100 years, if we're lucky, of consciousness and introspection and joy and laughter and wine and pizza and dogs and friends. And, oh, isn't it amazing? What an amazing chance. You know, 400 trillion to one that I exist as me. Mm. And then we die, never to exist again. There isn't a point, but we're here. And so what do we do with it? Well, we make the most of it. That's all we do. We make the most of it. And part of that is feeling good in your body, is feeling good in yourself, is happiness and joy. And there's lots of things bring you joy. You know, you could analyze it down to sharing, seeing other people happy. Nothing fills me with more joy than seeing a dog running around. I look at that. I know how happy that dog is.
Yeah.
And I feel it.
Yeah. I get it.
So we're looking for happiness. You know, and there's lots of caveats and conditions, as I said. And one big thing is sharing it and making sure everyone else is happy as well, to a certain degree. And so that's what afterlife's about, really. It's Tony trying to learn that. It's trying to learn that.
Well, and you see it, and, you know, for people that haven't seen it and for those that are excited about the series, I won't obviously blow any spoilers, but the last episode, I don't even know what words to use. I've certainly never cried so much with every emotion. It was a beautiful end to series two. And again, thank you for making it, because it certainly brought my husband and I a lot of joy each night, sort of, you know, sparingly watching one a night so we could eke it out. It was just perfect. So thank you so much. And
well, that's exactly what it's for. Exactly what it's for. And there's no better review. There's no better review than it brought us 26 minutes of joy. That's exactly it. And what I learned from series one is that can come from anywhere, because I've never had a reaction like it. And as I say, you know, it's not the size of the reaction. It was the emotional connection with people. People coming up to me on the street and saying, I lost my brother 3 weeks before I watched it. And it really happened, which is, I mean, incredible.
Yeah.
An incredible feeling of well-being when someone says that to you. It's entertainment with them, I suppose. But even just people thinking that's entertainment.
Yeah.
People don't realise that thinking is entertainment. That's why people play chess and Sudoku and crosswords, because thinking is entertaining.
Yeah, and often TV these days, well, doesn't often require much. You can just sit there and go, but this is all about thought and then discussing it after. And Jesse and I talked about all manner of subjects after watching each episode. And again, it's rare, I think, within TV. So it's
well, thinking
it
makes you a better person. I think that's it. It just, you know, that's why we dream. That's sometimes we haven't got time when we're awake, but your brain goes, right, let's have a look at this. And it does it in weird symbolic, you know, but it's going, let's have a look at this. Let's have a look. Some people have only got time when they're asleep.
Yeah.
But it's sleeping's good. I'd put sleeping, that on the list. That's great, isn't it?
I don't get that in this house. I don't get any sleep. I can't talk about sleep. Look, Ricky, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I can't say how much I love the series. Again, it is just a beauty. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
And take care of yourself.
Thank you. It's been weird having a chat with someone with a duvet on their head.
But you won't forget it. You won't forget this podcast.
Yes, brilliant. Thank you very much.
Bye, Ricky.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Ricky. I so loved chatting to you underneath my duvet on the floor of my stepson's bedroom. It was such an interesting, wonderful chat. A man who is living his best life in lockdown. You enjoy that pasta, mate. Now, the second series of Afterlife is available on Netflix right now. I urge you to watch it. It is sublime. Don't forget to subscribe to get new episodes of the show every Monday straight to your phone. You can do that for free on your podcast app of choice. Thanks again to Ricky, to the producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, and to you lot for listening. I'll see you next week.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.